Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I'm your host, Gary Gramling. I am joined once again by Jenny Brentis of the Weekside Podcast. Jenny, it was a wild card weekend full of memories. I think we made memories this weekend.
There were a lot of memories to be made. Slime. There was the Browns and the Bills, two fan bases that have struggled for a long time. I once did a series called The Corridor of Doom, where I visited the Bills, the Browns, and the Lions. And two of these franchises have really turned things around. And,
the Lions still have a team in Detroit.
The Lions still have a team, right? Jared Goff coming in despite the thumb injury. Yeah, there was a lot to break down, Gary.
There was, so we had the six games. That's a first for Wild Card Weekend. I thought it was nice that some of these games just provided a little bit of a break. We didn't really have to be too enthralled with them. We had good ones, and then we had two really bad ones, and that was kind of nice.
It did work out well that Bears Saints was the Nickelodeon broadcast. I know you may have different feelings on the Nickelodeon broadcast, but it was a nice break from just being so locked into every single play. I turned on the Nickelodeon broadcast. It was a little bit more fun. And it was, you know, at that point, after four games on Wild Card Weekend where you're just staring at the TV, it was nice to just feel a little bit more casual about a viewing experience.
I'm going to be such a grump when we get there. Everyone's going to hate me by the end of this show. No, I won't be that grumpy. I liked the concept. There were some good things about it. Well, we'll get to it when we get to it. When we talk Saints Bears. But let's start Sunday night with the Browns. What a first quarter, and what sort of a deserving swing of karma, good fortune falling on his team for the first 15 minutes of this game.
That was a really stunning beginning just from that first snap. And here you have Marquise Pouncey, who has been in the past an all-pro center. You have this wild snap that, you know, they have a chance to retrieve on the goal line, but they don't. So it's like the worst possible outcome. I mean, yeah, there's a bad snap and yeah, there's a big loss, but not in this case. The Browns scored a touchdown on it. So, and then it continued to snowball. It didn't end there. It wasn't one big play. You know, you think sometimes, well, it goes wrong at the start, but the Steelers are a veteran team. They've been in the playoffs. They'll just get things right. But instead, it just continued to snowball over the whole first half.
I mean, there's a still shot. I should find it and like tweet it or something if I was more active on social media. There's a still shot from one of the wires where the ball is sitting on the one. You have Roethlisberger and Connor both standing over it about to pounce on it, and there are no Browns players in the frame, and it's just like, wow, how did this end up in the end zone for a touchdown? That is just a really weird thing. And like you said, Marquise Pouncey is not, this was not like an issue that's come up in the past with like bad snaps or something like that. For this game to start with a bad snap from your center who's been there forever, who's never had an issue with bad snaps, I don't know. Again, it's just the football gods just sort of being like, I think this has been enough for Browns and their fans. And let's give them a little bit of a break here for a little bit. As far as Cleveland went, again, you had no Kevin Stefanski, no Joel Bitonio, no Denzel Ward, a couple other assistant coaches out, including their top two offensive line coaches. And then mid-game, they lose Jack Conklin, they lose Michael Dunn, who had been filling in for Bitonio, and Blake Hance is the guy who was referred to as Guy Named Blake. If you saw the Baker Mayfield post-game interview, he ends up on the field, and the Browns all of a sudden have just this, it's this scotch-taped offensive line as they try to cling to this lead.
And what was remarkable was with the fact that it was a scotch tape offensive line play was one of the biggest reasons that the Browns won. And really one of the biggest reasons that they had this turnaround this season. For assistant coach of the year, I voted for Bill Callahan because the offensive line play was really the key to the whole Browns resurgence. I mean, obviously Kevin Stefanski has done a lot to institute a new offense, get Baker Mayfield playing well, also changing this long downtrodden Browns culture, but the offensive line play has been such a key to unlocking Baker Mayfield's ability to play well. And the fact that they could do it even with new guys shuffled in without coaches on the sideline providing instruction just proves how well trained the veterans have been throughout the rest of the season too.
So obviously this one got a little bit dicey in the second half, and the Steelers were coming back, and it seemed like, you know, everyone loves the narrative. It seemed like the Steelers might come back and steal this game when it was all said and done. This was, to me, the turning point. And look, everyone hated the Mike Tomlin punt from midfield on a 4th-and-1, and Lord knows the Steelers are probably feeling a little bit snake-bitten about short yardage situations this year, but they punted away. This is, we can hate on the punt, but this is what I loved about that. The Browns got the ball back. They get the touchback. They get it at the 20. They've gone nowhere for their first three drives of the second half. They went out not only throwing the ball, they went tempo. They just absolutely took the opportunity to take the game back. They went 6 plays, 2 minutes, 20 seconds, score a touchdown, and that was kind of it. I mean, the Steelers suddenly just go meek and timid, and the Browns just say, okay, well, we're just going to be the aggressors and win the game.
It wasn't just the decision to punt. I'm with you, Gary. It was the fact that when the Browns got the ball back, they were aggressive and they didn't allow themselves to collapse. That's kind of what it looked like might be happening. They have this tremendous first half, tremendous first quarter, and then, you know, as has been true for the franchise, somehow, some way, they find things to mess it up. But this group was different. They resolved that they were not going to. They were aggressive. And Mike Tomlin was putting trust in the Steelers' defense at that point when he punted the ball away, because they had been playing well the last few possessions. But the Browns made that a non-factor.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's almost like there's this assumption that the Browns were just going to go run, pass for the rest of the game, and instead they just went out and were like, okay, well, we're going to need more points, so let's go get points. And again, it was a 6-play drive. It was 5 passes, and it was tempo. They didn't run the clock down, and it was I don't know. I thought it was just really awesome to see, and good on Alex Van Pelt and Baker Mayfield and the entire unit for getting this done when they needed to score a few more points. So the Browns go to Kansas City next Sunday. It's going to be the early game. Now everyone in the industry gets to tweet out the same Texas Tech Oklahoma box score that we've seen nonstop for the last couple of years. So look forward to that on social media. But as far as the Steelers go, so many questions going into this offseason, and the biggest one is Ben Roethlisberger, who's been the franchise quarterback there since 2004. And look, it was an ugly performance. He ends up throwing for 500 yards. So if you had him in some sort of fantasy league, you were probably pretty pumped. But 4 interceptions, 2 of them sort of, you know, tip ball type of bad break type of things, and 2 of them just really, really bad interceptions. The ball was just not coming out of his hand well. He had that one throw in the second quarter where he stepped up in the pocket. I think it was Deontay Johnson he had coming back to the ball downfield on the left sideline. And it came up like 12 yards short. And it was just sort of a reminder that, yes, we knew he was in physical decline here, but it was pretty sharp this year. And it has to be frustrating for him. And you saw him emotional on the sideline after the game. It has to be incredibly frustrating for him, a guy who was such a dominant physical force for the bulk of his career, to just not be able to do the things that he used to do, and just not even to be able to come close to doing those things anymore.
Yeah, I think that's really well said, Gary, because at his peak, he was a player with a really strong arm and a player that you just couldn't sack, right? That was always kind of the joke, is that you just couldn't get Big Ben down. He was standing tall back there. He was this massive man, and it was really hard to bring him to the ground. And ultimately, now you have a quarterback who, I think that it was the first interception, I believe, that came out as a very fluttery pass. And the pass that you just detailed about being well short of Deontay Johnson. And also just his lack of physical mobility shows up in so many different ways. I think it has really held the offense back in terms of scheme, doing many of the things that we see other offenses around the league doing. They just can't because of his lack of mobility. You wondered if that was also a factor in his not diving for the ball on the bad snap on the opening play. Kind of seemed like he was standing around waiting for someone else to pounce on it, or seeing how far away the Browns players were. You know, he's really been physically diminished, and coming off elbow surgery, the talk from the Steelers was that he was going to be back and better than ever, and he looked to be in good shape. But ultimately, the Steelers limped to the end of the season because Ben was limping to the end of the season.
Yeah, and the first half of the season, when they sort of rolled out some of this motion stuff, some of this horizontal attacking stuff, and it was new and it was working because it was new, it was kind of like, okay, well, maybe we have something going forward here. But it never expanded off of that, which is really what you have to do. And you just have to ask yourself, number one, Ben has to figure out whether he wants to do this going forward. When you play a style of football where it's only quick game, it's only quick strike, the ball has to come out of your hand right away, that the fact that he played that style the entire season kind of tells you how he feels about his body holding up. But number two, it's like you can't go through this again. If you're the Steelers, you can't play an entire season like this and trust that your defense is going to stand on its head and your offense is going to be limited. You have to figure out a better solution with what they're doing, because again, they struggled to run the ball all season. But part of that was because every defense just got to put all 11 defenders within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage because they knew the ball wasn't going downfield. So a lot of answers here. James Conner is a free agent. Juju Smith-Schuster is a free agent, and you're going to hear me talk about this wide receiver free agent class to an obnoxious extent, because it is quite good, but it's also completely flooded, and you have a great draft class coming in. And I think a lot of these guys, whether it's Juju Smith-Schuster, T.Y. Hilton, Corey Davis, Will Fuller, these guys, I think they're expecting to get paid, and I don't think they're going to. And I think it's going to be a very interesting offseason here as far as that goes.
And I think the Steelers have a lot of team building questions to consider. Ben, after the game, said he would like to be back if the Steelers would have him, putting the ball in their court, which was unusual phrasing. And I think this was sort of a bad time for the Steelers to have a lull in the other areas of their offense, right? The offensive line play had not been what it was a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the same transcendent abilities at the skill positions. So it was, not only was Ben diminished, but the rest of the offense was diminished, and that ultimately resulted in the kind of loss we saw Sunday night.
Yeah, and Savvy, you wonder, with any great defense, you wonder what the window is, because it is difficult to stay at that level for year after year after year. And boy, really interesting offseason coming up here for Pittsburgh. And by the way, we're going to go reverse chronological order in these games if you do want to skip around, although why would you possibly want to skip around on this show? But let's go to the Sunday mid-afternoon game. That would be the Saints hosting the Bears, and as expected, just sort of had a comfortable win in this one, though they were a little bit sloppy offensively in the first half, and you wondered, okay, are the Bears going to stick around and sort of get a few bounces and maybe make this interesting? But No, that is not what happened.
Yeah, I thought the sloppiness in the first half for the Saints offense did matter. I mean, the Bears have been a good defense. They have Khalil Mack. You know, it was not a game in which they would face no resistance. But, you know, you're going into the next weeks of the playoffs and you want the offense to be clicking. And, you know, Michael Thomas makes his return and he looked good, and maybe it just, you know, they need a little bit more time to hit their peak form. But I would not say this was the peak form for the Saints offense.
It was Michael Thomas back in the line. He looked good. I think that was your most encouraging thing here for the Saints, besides from the fact that you won the game with relative ease and you get to play another playoff game next week. So that was good there. As far as the Bears go, and there was sort of this thinking emerging late in the season that Mitchell Trubisky had sort of found it and they had figured it out with him. And, you know, maybe he's not the quarterback of the future, but he's a guy they bring back next year, et cetera, et cetera. What you saw for the second straight week was a coach that didn't trust his quarterback, a very scaled back offense. I just don't understand how, considering how they called the game in these last 2 weeks, I don't understand how they can bring Trubisky back and sort of keep these training wheels on him. And this is not the offense that Matt Nagy wants to run. This is not the offense that Mitchell Trubisky is apparently comfortable winning. So I don't understand how they don't just make a clean break at this point.
And Gary, I know you were a little bit down on the Nickelodeon broadcast, but I will say that Nate mm-hmm. Burleson's explanation of the Trubisky situation on the Nickelodeon broadcast was perhaps one of the best explanations I've seen of it, basically likening it to being grounded. Trubisky was grounded when Foles started, and then he was ungrounded, but he still had restrictions and he couldn't leave the yard. And that was exactly what we saw in this game. They just don't trust him enough to give him the freedom that you need for a quarterback to win games. And there were some better performances down the stretch. Obviously, the Bears rallied a bit to get to the playoffs. But he can't be the answer in Chicago. We talked a couple weeks ago if he could be a bridge, and I still don't think that's a terrible idea. But you need to figure out some other plan, and you need to figure out how you're going to make that work.
He was voted the MVP of this game, so that's something to go out on. He threw a touchdown pass on his last throw of the season. That's also a nice ending if it ends that way. Again, I don't think Mitchell Trubisky is unsalvageable. I think he just has to go somewhere else and sort of get a new set of coaches in his ear and just go from there. It's just this match, this marriage is just not going to work. And I think the last 2 weeks were sort of a reminder of that. I didn't hate the Nickelodeon broadcast. I liked the concept. I liked some of the stuff they did. I will say I did have a live focus group in my house, age 6 months to 10 years, and we did put it on, and I was curious to know what they would think. And look, my first role at SI Kids, at Sports Illustrated was at SI Kids. I was there for 8 years. It is a tricky thing to put on these presentations because you have, like at SI Kids, our demographic was age 8 to age 14. If you know an 8-year-old and a 14-year-old, those are not things that cross over very much. Like you have to be very cognizant of what your audience is, and it's a very wide-ranging audience. It's not like adults. So as far as my kids went, they were very interested early on. They're sort of just getting into football here. They liked the slime cannon that excited them. But as far as just the explanations, some of the learning stuff, it just wasn't quite there for them. I don't know if some of the things could have been explained a little bit better. And then when it came down to it, it's very tough to do this over a three and a half hour game because there are just not that many wacky things you can mix in there. So my kids had both left the room about 20 minutes into the thing, and that's so, you know, on one hand I feel like they didn't really learn that much about football, and on the other hand they also it didn't keep them interested in actually sitting there and watching the game.
Yeah, no, those are fair points, Gary, and you know, holding the attention of the infant, they really have a long way to go in that regard.
he stayed in the room the longest. He stayed until the bitter end, which was like, I don't know, 14-3 or something like that in the third quarter.
Least mobile of your children.
Yes, that is very true. The most ambitious as far as mobility goes, but the least mobile. So yeah, I didn't. Again, I'm a grump, but yeah, I appreciate what they did. I just think they'll learn and they'll make it better going forward, because I'm sure they'll do it again. It seems like it was a relative success.
Yeah.
as far as the Saints go, they host the Bucks. That'll be round three between those teams. The Saints obviously just sort of smashed the Bucks in both their meetings this year. And we'll talk about it in a little bit, but I'm really interested to see what the Bucks offensive line does, because this seems to be some sort of kryptonite when they face New Orleans.
Yeah. And it's very hard to beat a team three times in one season.
It is. That is very true. All right, hang on 1 second, Jenny. We still have four games to go, but it is now time for the fantasy segment presented by DraftKings. I'm joined once again by Michael Fabiano, who is here every Monday, which you already knew. I don't know why I have to keep on saying that, but Fabs, we're going to run through sort of the a bit of the impact of some of the performances this weekend and some of the quite frankly some of the contract situations coming up with some of these guys. But let's start with and look, if you play postseason fantasy football, this was a big bummer if this guy was on your roster. And quite frankly, despite his great performance this season, there might be some question marks with Derrick Henry going forward as far as his value in fantasy coming off a 2,000-yard season.
Well, he was held in check. 8 points against Baltimore. That was it. I did a wild card weekend draft with my guys on Fantasy Dirt over at SiriusXM, and I had the number one overall pick, and I took Henry over Kamara.
Yeah. Dope! Yeah, well,
that did not work out well for me. And I will tell you this, Derrick Henry has been great the last couple of seasons, and he could very well be great again in 2021. Go and take a look at the history of running backs who've had 2,000 yards in a single season and what they've done the following year. Mm. And obviously regression is going to come, because 2,000 yard seasons don't come all the time. But the level of regression is scary. In fact, the only 2,000-yard rusher who went ahead and finished in the top 10 among running backs the following season was Chris Johnson in 2010. And Chris Johnson saw a 120-point decrease compared to his 2,000-yard campaign. I'll give you a quick overview. Eric Dickerson, 84. He was the RB3, he averaged 20 points a game. The following season, he was the RB19. He averaged 16 points per game. Adrian Peterson, 2012. That was that crazy season. Remember where he came off the ACL? Mm-hmm. Yep. And he had gotten drafted like third, fourth round in some leagues, because at that point, everyone was concerned about players coming off of ACLs. He had averaged almost 22 points per game. He was the RB1. The following year, averaged 17, he was the RB11. Jamal Lewis, he's like the forgotten 2,000-yard rusher. Mm-hmm. Now, he only played 12 games the following year. He averaged 13.7 points per game the year after his 2,000-yard season, during which time he averaged 20 points a game. Barry Sanders, 21.8 points per game to 15. Terrell Davis, he got hurt the year after his 2,000-yard season. Yep. So you can't even really put him into this list. But the fact that he got hurt, I mean, that's something that needs to be noted.
Yep.
I mentioned Chris Johnson. He went from 25 points per game to 17. 17's still pretty good.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, at that point, but it's a big decline.
No, I was surprised you said Chris Johnson, because as a guy who sort of retained top 10 status, because he was a disappointment that year. He was number one overall in every draft.
Yeah. And then OJ. So OJ, yeah. I mean, he averaged 20 points a game in 73, which is also the year of my birth. God, I'm getting old. The following year, 12 points a game. So, and I know it sounds weird, right? If I had told you last year at this time that Lamar Jackson was going to be the QB10 in 2020, mm-hmm. you would have thought I was absolutely out of my freaking mind. Folks, even the greatest players, look what happened to Michael Thomas this season. Even the greatest players can have serious declines. Beware the magical season. Put that phrase, I've used it for decades. Beware the magical season with Derrick Henry. I'm just telling you, he'll be a first-round pick across the board. And if I'm drafted and he's available, depending on where my draft position is, I'll probably take him.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a mistake. We'll see.
It's fluid. You know, there are a couple guys, though. Henry was a bummer, but there are a couple of young backs or youngish backs. I don't know if James Conner still qualifies as young at this point as far as running back age goes. But Cam Akers, real nice day in Seattle. And James Conner, you know, I mean, that Steelers running game that just disappeared for weeks and weeks.
No.
It was back. Everything else went wrong on Sunday night, but they could run the ball.
It was crazy. With Akers, like, this guy, he must be made of adamantium, because I thought he had a high ankle sprain. Remember, yeah. Like, and a week later, you know, he misses one game, and then he's putting up, you know, 25 plus touches, and didn't have a huge game in the finale. But last week, I mean, geez Louise, he had a 55% touch share. Mm-hmm. I hope this is a sign of things to come. I really do. If this is a sign of things to come for this kid, he's going to be a top 30 or 40 overall pick at worst. And you mentioned James Conner. He ended up with his best fantasy game in a while. Now, most of his production came as a pass catcher, right? He had 5 catches for 30 yards. He did score a touchdown on the ground, so that helped. But and Leonard Fournette, surprisingly, was the guy for the Buccaneers, because yeah. Ronald Jones couldn't get that quad loosened up. Apparently, he was dealing with swelling, so he couldn't go. And Fournette came out of nowhere, and no one drafted Fournette if you were playing in like a wild card weekend scenario. But the biggest surprises are Henry and David Montgomery was bad. I mean, David Montgomery had a 32% touch share and he scored 3 points. And let me tell the audience right now, David Montgomery was great down the stretch. He was a league winner. Pat him on the back. Congratulate him. Don't draft him in the top 20 next season. Just don't do it. I feel like he could end up being a bust because of the expectations. Folks, he put up great numbers against some of the worst run defenses in the league. And he did exactly what he should have done. Let's see what his schedule is like next season.
And, a couple guys maybe moving teams, maybe moving on. We talked about Ben at the top of this show. But this Steelers offense might look a whole lot different as far as the skill position guys go. Ben, what's his future? And then Juju Smith-Schuster, is he coming back there?
From a fantasy perspective, I hope Ben is back. The top 5 wide receivers this weekend, based on fantasy points, 3 of them were Steelers. And Deontay Johnson's been great all year. Chase Claypool, he started to see his numbers decline in the second half, but the man was a touchdown machine. Juju, I don't know where he'll end up. I don't know. He said after the game he wanted to remain a Steeler. I wonder if there's going to be a little stink on him, though, because of the TikTok crap and talking trash about the Browns, giving them some sort of, you know, locker room, you know, bulletin board material. He might be the odd man out. I don't know. I hope the Steelers just remain. Where else are they going to go at quarterback? Like, I mean, who's their future? Is it Mason Rudolph? I don't think so. So let's hope that Ben stays there for one more year. The Steelers organizationally go ahead and try to figure out who their future quarterback is going to be. But Juju, I mean, James Conner's a free agent too.
Mm-hmm.
That's something to keep in mind. And I will be writing a column on my 2021 offseason wish list here once we get through the postseason. So make sure you check that one out. It's always fun.
Well, there you go. I mean, Fabs is here every Monday, but he's there every day. SI.com/fantasy, SI Fantasy Podcast. Fabs, we'll have 4 more to go next week, and we'll see what the fantasy implications that come out of a divisional playoff weekend or conference semifinal weekend. That's what it should be called, conference semifinal weekend. We'll see what goes on there.
Yeah, man, I'm looking forward to these games. I wonder what the Browns can do for an encore, right? I'll tell you, nobody thought they were going to beat Pittsburgh outside of the state of Ohio. Nobody, or Browns fans, nobody. And you know what? Nobody thinks they're going to beat the Chiefs. Nobody. Imagine if they go into Arrowhead and beat the Chiefs. Goodness gracious. I mean, like, people like to be cliche and say anything can happen. I don't think anything can happen, but some odd stuff did happen this past weekend.
Get their head coach. They get Joe Bitonio. They get Denzel Ward back. Reinforcements coming.
That game got a lot more interesting. Let's put it that way. It's going to get a lot more interesting with those players back, with Stefanski back on the sidelines. I wish we had a live cam of Stefanski's,
I know,
wherever he was, in the basement, at his mom's house, whatever the case may be. That would have been a lot of fun. But the Browns and the Rams, too. I didn't expect the Rams to win, honestly. Seattle, that's another thing that we're going to talk about probably in the offseason. Russell Wilson.
Yeah.
After an historic start, statistically, well, Russ wasn't cooking in the second half.
They need to figure out what they want to be offensively there. I know.
And Chris Carson's a free agent, too.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a lot of stuff to talk about, man. There's no offseason.
Never is. Yep. All right, Fabs. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, man. Go easy.
All right. So the Ravens, Lamar Jackson, finally. I mean, this guy's been choking for decades in playoff games. So he finally gets his playoff win 3 days after turning age 24. So that is, I don't know. I'm thankful not to be able or not have to listen to the Lamar playoff narrative anymore. And I'm hoping the Lamar comeback narrative goes away very soon. I'm not sure this game quite did it, though. But when it all comes down to it, Lamar Jackson has won a playoff game. And aside from one ugly interception in the first quarter, he won it in the way that the Ravens want to win games.
Yeah. I think a lot of narratives were corrected in this game too, Gary. You know, they'd lost to the Titans twice in the last year. There was Marquise Brown midseason was frustrated about not getting targeted enough over the last few weeks of the season. And also in this game, that has certainly changed. But the thing about the playoff narrative with Lamar Jackson, I'm totally with you. It didn't matter. I mean, it was unfair to be putting it out there as if it was this long-standing failing. You know, his first year, he took over as a starter midway through, and then they lose the playoff game. Last year, it was, you know, just a lot of reasons. The defense didn't play well. The offense got out of its identity early on. But what I will say is, Lamar Jackson didn't just wave off the idea of this narrative. Like, he confronted it, and he said he wanted to change the narrative. That was his message all week. He wasn't saying that it was unfair. He, too, wanted to win a playoff game, and the two playoff losses in his first two seasons he also thought were failures. Not failures in a way of some kind of referendum on his career, but they were failures to him nonetheless. And so I think he had a good approach in saying, I want to change the narrative because that means I will then have won a playoff game, which will keep my season alive and keep me on track to winning a championship. So I liked the way he handled it. And I thought this performance was exactly what you want. You know, he rushed for over 100 yards. That is a big part of the Ravens' identity. But he also used his legs to make plays in the passing game. You know, there was one that he kind of kept the play alive. Adoree Jackson was kind of charging towards him, and Lamar Jackson was able to kind of scoot out to the right sideline and complete that pass to Mark Andrews, which kept alive Baltimore's first scoring drive. That led to a field goal after they'd fallen into a 10-0 deficit. You know, and then, of course, obviously his touchdown run. It was, 48 yards, Gary, if I have off the top of my head. 48-yard touchdown run where he reached a peak velocity of more than 20 miles per hour. So it was just a combination of all of the things that make Lamar Jackson good as a quarterback. It was not perfect. The interception was really ugly. The first, you know, the first two drives of the day were ugly for the Ravens offense. But he did the things that you need to do to win games and to, you know, make defenses kind of give up, as some of the players seemed to do on that touchdown run.
I'm glad you brought up the Adoree Jackson play because, you know, if you're the Titans, you're blitzing Adoree Jackson because he's a former track star. He is, I don't know what he ran at the combine. I'm going to guess he was like a high.
It was 4.39.
There you go. I was going to say high 4.3s.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's the reason you blitz him is because, okay, well, Lamar won't get away from him. And he did. And this was just sort of a reminder. And I don't know if people have forgotten, but he hasn't played, you know, Lamar Jackson hasn't played a primetime game in a while, but he just moves at a different speed than pretty much anyone in the league at this point. And you saw it on the touchdown run, and you saw it on that play, which absolutely should have ended in a sack. And it didn't. Instead, it ended up in a pretty big play there. The other thing I want to throw out narrative-wise, as long as we're talking about narratives I don't like, this, you know, Ravens can't come back sort of narrative. Steve Levy had mentioned on the broadcast that it had been last 4 years they had not come back from a 10-point deficit in any game, and obviously they have now, but... Lamar Jackson has only they play with the lead. They get the lead. That's why they don't have a whole lot of opportunities to come back in these games. You know, the Titans had an opportunity to come back 10 times this year. That is a literal 10 times, not an approximation. Lamar over the last two seasons, this was only his seventh time he's trailed by 10 points in a game. One time, if you go back over the last two times before this game, it was the Steelers' loss midseason where he came back. They took the lead. He gave them the lead back in the fourth quarter, and then they ultimately lost the game. So I guess he doesn't get credit for a win there, obviously. But he did come back in that game. And the other one was that monsoon, that Sunday night monsoon in Foxborough, where I'm not sure anyone was going to come back in that game. So you have this incredibly small sample size, and these stats sound so damning when you put the time frame on them and you don't actually say it's been X amount of games, and just everyone's kind of running with them. And he's not the first guy I'd pick if I needed to score a lot of points late in the game, but he's not problematic in these scenarios.
Wow. Gary, I love how you just break down statistics and point out whether they're actually valid or not. And that was... That when you hear the number of times he's even had the chance to do that, that really changes those numbers a lot. Also, the Ravens have had a pretty good defense for most of those 4 years. So It makes sense that they would have fewer times when they have fallen into a large deficit.
Thanks, Jenny. That was very complimentary. That's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me.
Good start to a Monday.
Now I'm all flustered here. let's go back. Let's yell about stuff. Let's yell about bad punts. Mike Vrabel. I love Mike Vrabel as a coach. I will take Mike Vrabel as the coach of my organization anytime. Two things he did on Sunday that I really disliked. And the first of them was this punt on 4th and 2 from the Ravens 40 in the fourth quarter, because look, the way this game was going, Derrick Henry did not have it going. This Ravens front absolutely dominated the game. You know, last time they met in the season, Brandon Williams was out, Calais Campbell was out. Those guys were back. Derek Wolfe was great in this game. Pernell McPhee and Matt Judon were spectacular in this game. I mean, they were just completely controlling the line of scrimmage. But if you are Mike Vrabel, you have this high pedigree offense and you need 2 yards, and to put it on your defense that has struggled all year, and it kind of, it ended up the way you would think it would end up. The Ravens got the ball back. They go on a nearly 7-minute drive. They kick a field goal to stretch the lead, and that was kind of it.
I totally agree, Gary. It was a head scratcher of a decision. They only gained 25 yards of field position from the punt. So you're at a point in the field where there isn't a lot of benefit to punting. Also, you know, there was 10 minutes left in the game, okay, but you know that the Ravens have the ability to drain the clock when they get the ball back. You know that they are an offense that is capable of a lot of run plays that take a lot of time off the clock. So you were somewhat in a crunch, and it was a day when you had not scored a lot of points. You had scored 13 points, and you have 10 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. So it seems like you have the opportunity to gain those 2 yards, and that would have been, that was a very baffling decision.
It was hard to figure out, and then obviously they get the ball back one more time. Ryan Tannehill, who had a shaky day, which happens sometimes when they're playing from behind and they sort of have to change what they do offensively. And Tannehill has, again, they had 10 fourth quarter comeback opportunities. He delivered in 5 of them, which is all good. But he misses AJ Brown down the left sideline, and tries to force a throw to Khalif Raymond, and Raymond ends up getting he falls down or gets knocked down, however you want to look at it. He fell down is how I look at it.
I looked at it as he fell down as well, Gary. I was surprised to see that this was even a point of contention in the post game, but Vrabel really seemed bothered by that.
He was really bothered by it, which again, it's the officiating isn't always great in the NFL, and sometimes you have to blow off some steam, and that's the way it goes. I haven't watched every play and every interaction in this game, so maybe there is something will come out where I, you know, kind of say, oh, okay, I guess Vrabel had a point. I don't think he had an argument on this play. On top of that, they benefited from a pretty blatant offensive pass interference on their only touchdown of the game, which is fine. I mean, you know, it's a physical game. They let AJ Brown get away with a little bit of a push off. It happens. It's not shocking. But then you had a ticky-tack offensive pass interference call that took away a Ravens fourth down conversion. I thought the Titans, and again, we'll see what all the interactions were, and maybe some things were missed just watching the broadcast, but I thought the Titans got the better side of the officiating. I thought they absolutely benefited from the officiating in this game. So to get upset about this, where your quarterback makes, quite frankly, just a really poor decision and forces a throw up the seam that is probably not going to get completed anyway. Maybe you say, okay, it shouldn't have ended in an interception, but it was not going to be a good play for the Titans. I don't know. It just seemed really petty and disappointing to hear him sort of railing on the officiating of all things in this game.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the AJ Brown touchdown, he clearly extended his left arm, so a flag was warranted. But okay, so if you're not going to call that play, then it makes sense you're not going to call whatever Vrabel thought might have happened on the Marcus Peters, Khalif Raymond interaction.
Yeah, and even that, I mean, I still just don't think, even if you're calling it tight, I just don't think it was anything that would resemble a penalty on that.
And I feel the same.
Sometimes just whatever, it's an emotional game. You get fired up. I'm sure he didn't like the Ravens stomping on their painted grass after they had yelled at each other about the Titans stomping on the Ravens painted grass earlier this season, and that's just the way it goes.
It's an unlikely rivalry.
It is. It's pretty cool though. And if you are 112 years old like I am, you remember very well these old, you know, Steelers Oilers and then Steelers Titans type rivalry games. And so it's nice to get the Titans sort of involved in this. And they're sort of a faux AFC South team as far as I am concerned. They belong in the AFC North, and they should have these games with these AFC North teams all the time.
That's totally fair.
As far as the Ravens go, they go to Buffalo Saturday night in what is just going to be a mind-blowing performance. And because we're all so amped up for it, it'll probably disappoint. It'll be like a 6-3 game or something like that. But this Lamar Jackson versus Josh Allen, they played last year. Lamar Jackson obviously was in the midst of an MVP season. Josh Allen was not quite at the level he's at now. But see these two young quarterbacks go at it will be just kind of wonderful.
Yeah.
But let's go back to this past Saturday night with the Bucs taking on the football team in Washington, and the Bucs do win this game. The big thing for the Bucs in this one was the offensive line held up really well, and you look at what they did to finish the season. It was good, but it was also against a lot of teams that don't have a pass rush. Washington has a pass rush. And look, Tampa held up. They gave up a couple pressures, a couple sacks after Alex Kappa, their right guard, went down. And Ted Larson, kind of a veteran, but kind of a limited veteran, went in there and couldn't quite hold his own. So, yeah, that's a little bit problematic. But overall, they won the battle of the trenches in this one.
Yeah, I was watching that for most of the game, expecting that to be the most intriguing thing that came out of this game. Taylor Heinicke, which we'll get to in a second, was an unexpected surprise. But Brady was clean for most of the game. You referenced the three sacks, but other than that, he didn't have a lot of pressure. He had plenty of time to execute. I believe one of the sacks came on play 6 seconds into after the snap, so that wasn't on the offensive line. And I was watching some of the ways that they were mitigating that Washington front, and watching Donovan Smith versus Chase Young was really interesting. And basically Smith did whatever he could to impede Young's path to the quarterback. And a lot of times that kind of involved pushing him wide and long so that he was going past Brady. And it would just be a longer route to get to the spot. And by that time, Brady would have gotten the ball out. So I think the Bucs are in a really good position moving forward. And to your earlier point about how they'll match up against the Saints front, but they have a lot of, you know, this was a very affirming game in terms of how they can handle a strong front. And that has always been the key to any quarterback's performance, but Brady's, you know, will he have time? Will there be pressure up the middle? Can you get to him or not? That is, was obviously the storyline in the Super Bowls that he's lost. So I think that was a really encouraging performance for the Bucs and an indication that, you know, this could be a team that could go a long way. I will say, you know, there were some other parts of the performance that were less encouraging, however, and the fact that it was such a tight game against a Washington team that, you know, we didn't think would contend at all.
I know. Taylor Heinicke. So I don't know where Taylor Heinicke was all year. part of this is, and we all got a little bit carried away because their quarterback play has just been unacceptably bad all year. And they've been running out three guys who just, you know, Alex Smith is a great story. Kyle Allen, a nice sort of guy to have around since he knows the system. Dwayne Haskins, we kind of know what went down there. But none of those three guys played a level of quarterbacking that belongs in the NFL, and I'm not quite sure how else to put it. But Taylor Heinicke goes out there, and all of a sudden you have a guy making plays with his legs, but also just getting the ball downfield at like the intermediate, deep intermediate levels in a way that they just haven't done. I mean, Terry McLaurin is on this team, and I feel like people forget that because he just doesn't get used in the way that he should be used. And, you know, Cam Sims is making some plays downfield. It just looked like an NFL passing game for, quite frankly, probably the only time all season.
Yeah, I mean, you would see him have plays, third down plays, and he would convert the down. And that was kind of unheard of for this Washington offense, right? If they got into a bad situation, it just seemed like there was, you know, they got behind the sticks. It seemed like there was no way out. And Heinicke figured out ways to keep the ball moving. And I mean, clearly his touchdown dive was the most thrilling play, mm-hmm. but there were a lot of other smaller plays, you know, a 24-yard pass and an 18-yard pass, keeping drives alive, both with his legs and with his arm, that were pretty impressive.
I mean, I don't know what they do at quarterback. They have to address it in one way or another. I don't think Taylor Heinicke is the guy who they're counting on to be their starter week one next year, but yeah. Absolutely, he's earned a right to be on that roster next year. I would not be bothered if you know, they sort of treated him as a bridge guy, depending on who they bring in. Let's say they go get Trey Lance or someone like that, the North Dakota State guy who might need a little bit of seasoning. It wouldn't bother me at all if Taylor Heinicke was the guy they went to for the first month or so of the 2021 season. But I think he just shown that he is going to be in the NFL, even if it's as a backup. There's nothing wrong with that, but he can go out there and just have an offense function as it's supposed to function.
Yeah, and there's probably some takeaway here about how messed up the NFL's developmental channels are for quarterbacks. That is why there had been a push in recent years for leagues, spring leagues like the AAF and the XFL. Heinicke was part of the XFL. He was a backup. He didn't get off the bench, so wasn't like he put a lot on film there. But that was his employer at the start of this year. And it's just kind of a wild turn to think that you have this quarterback who was signed to Washington's practice squad in December who could make a playoff game against Tom Brady interesting. And you just wonder how many players would have the skill sets that have just fallen through the cracks over the years.
Yeah. And I mean, look, we don't have to rehash Tom Brady's origin story. Tom Brady was a sixth round pick who might have never gotten on the field for New England if Drew Bledsoe does not get hurt. So it's been an ongoing thing for decades now, and people are trying to find solutions, but they're maybe not quite there yet. As far as Washington goes, yes, they'll address the quarterback position in some form. this offseason. Obviously, they feel good about what they do defensively. And as for the Bucks, they go on to New Orleans for round three. And again, I think I'm the only person in the world who can say I really like Donovan Smith. I think there are people who like Donovan Smith. I really like Donovan Smith. I appreciate the fact that he's sort of been the left tackle and been asked to single block in so many different variations of an offense that just asks the quarterback to hold on the ball for so long. He's not in a scheme that does a left tackle any favors, and he sort of just held on as a quality player for a while. He was really good in this game on Saturday night. I don't know what happens when they play the Saints. Trey Hendrickson turns into Reggie White, and Cam Jordan just completely dominates, and I don't know. I worry for them going into next week's matchup because it's just the way it goes.
Yeah, I believe Ali Marpet was out for the last Saints matchup. Is that correct, Gary?
Yeah, that Sunday night game in Tampa.
Yeah, so, yep. And he's been a great part. I actually voted him all pro. But he's been, and I think the fact that the line and the offense struggled more in the games, the handful of games he did miss this season, reinforced what he brings to that line. So that will be one potential difference in the playoff matchup.
Mid-afternoon Saturday, we have the Rams going up to Seattle, another round three matchup here. The Rams get this one. They've sort of just had the Seahawks number for the most part of the last couple of years. And look, this was the defense was absolutely dominant. Even after losing Aaron Donald for the fourth quarter of this game, they just stayed dominant. They completely just had a bead on what the Seahawks wanted to do offensively. And, I mean, my goodness, Brandon Staley is very firmly in head coaching conversations because of performances like this from his unit.
Yeah, and really, that was good coaching scouting by Sean McVay to bring Staley to his staff, you know, make mm-hmm. the defensive coordinator change, bring Staley to his staff. He obviously recognized that he had the ability to lead a defense like this. And there was a little bit of a jump there, you know, in his career path. And I think that's what you see. That's what makes staff successful. I was thinking about, you know, some of the offensive coordinators that Mike Vrabel has had. You know, he had Matt LaFleur, now he has Arthur Smith, and it's being able to identify a coach perhaps on the other side of the ball from what you coach that will be able to lead that unit well. And Brandon Staley has really done an amazing job. They're obviously well coached. No better example of that than the Darius Williams interception that led to the pick six. It was all film study. It was all anticipating, knowing exactly what was going to happen on the play and being in position to snatch the ball away.
Boy, that was breathtaking.
I couldn't believe that happened. That really was.
It was. There are very few things you see during an NFL game that are maybe once or twice a season where you're legitimately shocked and you've just never seen that scenario before. And that was one of them. Yeah, it's as far as this defense goes, again, and people will say nice things about Brandon Staley for a long time, so we don't need to go too deep into it, but they came into the season, and you looked at this defense on paper, and you said, wow, this is, you know, they have Aaron Donald, they have Jalen Ramsey, but that might be kind of it. Like, there's just not a you know, John Johnson's a really good player. Taylor Rapp, who's out right now, is a nice piece on the back end, too. But it was just kind of like, you know, do they have enough outside of those two guys? And the fact that just guys like Darius Williams, they just sort of fill out the roster, and they trusted these guys to be taught properly and to be coached up. And it's happened. And that's why you see them able to do what they're doing, again, even after losing Aaron Donald in this game. Lots more injuries on the Rams side. John Walford leaves this game in the first quarter, and Jared Goff has to come out and play through the thumb injury. And it wasn't very pretty, wasn't very good overall, but, you know, you sort of give him the credit for playing through the recently cut up thumb here. And he certainly, Goff did enough in this game.
Yeah. And to be honest, I thought he deserved a little bit more praise on the broadcast for playing through it. I mean, they had that zoomed in shot where you could see that the thumb was not normal. His left thumb was able to point straight up, and the right thumb was kind of in this feeble like position. It's really remarkable that he was able to come into the game – And he, you know, McVay didn't believe that he was healthy enough to start, but yet he plays well enough for the Rams to win against the Seahawks in Seattle.
Yeah, and he, look, he stood in. He took some hits. And again, I don't like giving just tough guy points for the sake of giving tough guy points, but he gets some tough guy points for this game because he took some hits, and you could sort of see him trying to protect that thumb on the way down when he got knocked down a couple of times. And I don't know, the fact that they tried to sneak for the game-clinching first down there on a fourth and inches, I don't know how I feel about it. I don't think it was particularly wise to do that, but I kind of shows that I guess there's some confidence in it going forward.
Yeah, and one thing I was thinking of after the game, you mentioned the other week, Gary, that when the Rams lost to the Seahawks, I think you mentioned, well, it doesn't really matter. I mean, if, as long as you get in the playoffs, seeding this year isn't quite as important. Only one team gets a bye in each conference, and home field advantage hasn't been a thing this season. Road teams won more often than home teams and won't be as huge of a factor in the postseason. And that was kind of the Rams' mindset going in, that it didn't matter that they lost to Seattle in week 16 and thus lost the division title. Whatever, we're on equal footing here. We're going into Seattle. We can end your season now. And that was clearly a motivating force that they felt like the Seahawks really celebrated that win and winning the division. And their point was ultimately didn't really matter. And they came in and got their vengeance when it did really matter.
Yep. We had road teams had a winning record during the regular season. They also won 4 of the 6 games in wild card weekend. So we're seeing it. There's not the home field advantage that there used to be, although perhaps there is when you go up to Lambeau Field and the right. conditions are a little bit different, which is where the Rams are going Saturday afternoon. Andrew Whitworth was back in the lineup and for the Seahawks game. Cooper Kupp left with knee bursitis at the very end, sort of a non-contact injury. I'm not quite sure what his status is going to be, so lots of questions here. By the way, knee bursitis is sort of a classic Madden injury for anyone who played that game in the in the mid-aughts or so. A lot of guys leaving games with bursitis. But Whitworth back, Kupp, Donald, and Goff, and Walford, all various varying degrees of question marks as they get ready for the Packers here. And as far as the Seahawks go, again, just sort of a weird season. Offensively, it was let Russ cook early on, and then they backed off of that when there was just a rash of turnovers that came midseason. And it sort of tried to turn back to defense and ball control and play action off of that, and it just never really, it never really felt right all season for Seattle.
Yeah, it, and they have a, I don't know, they have a lot of questions now to answer in the offseason too. I mean, I think these are both difficult off seasons for the Seahawks and the Steelers. And you look back at Seattle's recent history, and they haven't made it past the divisional round since they won the Super Bowl. They've either lost on wild card weekend or lost in the divisional round. So since their last Super Bowl appearance.
Yes.
They won the Super Bowl, then they went to the Super Bowl the next year, lost to the Patriots. But since then, they haven't made it past the divisional round.
Yeah, and look, the last 4 years, their only postseason win was over the Josh McCown Eagles in Philadelphia last year. So they have some things to figure out. We'll see. The defense was better down the stretch. Do you have something there? You got to figure out something different to do with Jamal Adams than asking him to cover all these slot receivers all year, because that was not working, including in this game. And let's finish our trip back to the past or whatever we're doing here. But the first game of Wild Card Weekend, Bills Colts, which was a real good one. And look, if you've listened to the show for years, you know how I feel about the Bills and the entire region of Western New York. So please don't take this too personally. But the Colts outplayed the Bills in this game, and I think they outplayed them pretty thoroughly. The Bills just didn't bring their A game to this one. The Colts did. And just a number of moments. Every one of those moments that sort of decide games, those like 8 to 10 plays, they all just, none of them broke the Colts' way.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. And Frank Reich got a lot of criticism for decisions that I think were defensible. And I think ultimately, the Colts really hung in the game with a very talented Bills team until they didn't anymore.
It was, so the Colts end up no turnovers, only two penalties in this game. They outgained the Bills by 75 yards. They go 9 for 17 on third down. This came down to red zone efficiency. The Bills had two red zone trips. They scored 14 points. The Colts had five red zone trips. They scored 16 points. The Colts rookie kicker doinks a 33-yard attempt. Tyler Bass nails his 54-yard attempt. I mean, there are just a number of things. You know, Gabriel Davis on a fantastic 96-yard touchdown drive at the end of the first half in the final minute 46. Gabriel Davis makes two catches on the sideline, which, depending on how they're ruled on the field, that's how it was going to stand up. They were just too close to say yes or no and overturn it on the replay. So just those little things just sort of all went against the Colts in this one. And again, the Bills get plenty of credit. Big-time goal line stand at the end of the first half to set up that 96-yard touchdown run. Mario Addison made a great play on third and goal from the one to force Jonathan Taylor further outside. Ends up being a 3-yard loss when Tre'Davious White cleans it up. But as far as that play call went, and this is why I would defend Frank Reich on going for it on fourth and goal from the four, he's thinking not only can we get 7 instead of 3, which obviously always factors in, but he's thinking if we kick the field goal, we're settling for 3. We're also giving the Bills 20 yards of field position for their drive at the end of the first half, and they had 3 timeouts left. They had plenty of time, so that all factored into it. And obviously, it didn't work. They didn't get the touchdown, and then even worse, they give the 96-yard touchdown drive, even though at one point they did have the Bills stalled, and Kamiko Touré just jumping off sides on that 4th and 3 was something to behold. And if you saw the Colts, unfortunately for Touré, it was the camera angle had the Colts sideline in this game, and you could see how the Colts sideline reacted to their guy jumping off sides when the Bills were clearly only out there to try and draw an offsides penalty.
That was one of those moments where you're like, did that really just happen?
Oh, man.
But I mean,
you see all these like drawing them offside type of things, and it's always so annoying because you have to sit there. It's like, okay, they're just trying to draw them offside. So now we're going to sit here for 20 seconds while they do that, and then they're going to call timeout, and that'll be it. And it's such a waste of everyone's time. And to see someone actually, it just emboldened every team to start doing that for another like decade now.
Yeah. And I'm with you, Gary. I understood Reich's decision to go for it. It's pretty remarkable that the Bills then went 96 yards to score. So because they failed in the fourth down attempt and because the Bills marched 96 yards, it's looked at as a bad decision. But at the time when he made the call, I could totally see why he did. And I think the reasoning was correct.
I mean, I had no problem with any of Reich's game management situations, except for he had a terrible challenge where they ended up throwing away a timeout in the fourth quarter. I don't know why he challenged the Zach Moss non-fumble, which was clearly correctly ruled on the field, and they just threw away a timeout, which obviously they ended up very much needing down the stretch, because then you could have, you know, used the entire field, called the timeout, and set up for a potential game-tying field goal. As far as Josh Allen goes, that was the story going into the game, Josh Allen and just his just tremendous finish of the season. In light of kind of what happened last year in Houston in the wild card round, where it was something of a mini meltdown in the second half of that game, you kind of wondered, okay, how is he going to respond on the stage this year? Kind of a very Lamar-ish narrative going on.
Yeah.
Maybe cooking with Allen if it had been more than one playoff game, but he was good in this one. Maybe not as dominant as he had been. I thought he looked a little less decisive. I think that had a lot to do with what the Colts did defensively, a lot of disguise coverages. I thought the Colts went in with an absolutely perfect game plan for this one on both sides of the ball. Frank Reich, some of these over routes that sort of exploited the Bills' zone rules defensively were just absolutely perfect. I think the Colts are a quality team that maximized their chances to win this game. And just they needed to catch just one break, just one out of like 8 chances to get a break. They needed to get one, and they just didn't get it.
Yeah, that the margin was so thin in this game against the Bills team that had been so hot to close the regular season, I think was an impressive performance by the Colts. You wouldn't look at these two teams and, I mean, the Bills were clearly the better team, right? Mm-hmm. So the fact that the Colts played them tight all the way till the end and had, you know, a chance to win the game, I think was impressive. And I think because the breaks didn't go their way, shouldn't take away from the fact that they went in with a really smart game plan. They played the Bills really tough, and a better Bills team just won.
Yeah. Frank Reich, I thought he and his staff did as good a job as anyone did this wild card weekend here. And that includes even the Rams guys. The Bills knocked down the Hail Mary to win it in this one. I don't know how everyone felt out in that area of the country, but I imagine how it might have been when Phillip Rivers launched that ball in light of the end of their last loss. But it probably felt really good when they saw the ball was going to come 5 yards short of the goal line.
Yeah, and that was also, you know, raises the questions about, were they going to put Brissett in to throw the Hail Mary? And now you wonder what's next for Phillip Rivers. He is unsure if this was his last season. And so the Colts also have some interesting offseason questions.
Yeah, we'll see if Carson Wentz actually becomes available. They would presumably be in on that market. I don't know if they necessarily can draft a guy at this point, but decisions coming up for a Colts team that has a pretty good infrastructure on defense. I'm sure they would be okay with Phillip Rivers coming back. That worked out relatively well. Well enough.
Better than I expected, to be honest. I wasn't sure. You know, I didn't know that it was the answer. The Colts season exceeded my expectations. I thought maybe Phillip Rivers was, you know, he was going to play behind a better offensive line in Indy, but I didn't know if that would be enough. And it was. I mean, they had a strong season. It was an impressive run.
It's a good spot for him. So if he does continue playing, that seems like what he needs, which is, quite frankly, to be protected very, very well. And I'm not sure there are a lot of teams out there that can do that for him. All right, Jenny. We have lots to talk about all week on the Weak Side podcast. Albert Breer will have his show. It's called the Albert Breer Show, so it's very easy to find if you want to find it. But if you don't already, go ahead and subscribe to the Weak Side podcast. Jenny and Connor will have plenty more on Wild Card Weekend. I'm sure Connor has lots to crow about as far as the Cleveland Browns go.
Lots to discuss. Can't wait for that conversation.
The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is Jenny Vrentis and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed as well as the feeds for the Weak Side Podcast on the Albert Breer Show. They're all for free on Apple Podcasts. And once you do subscribe, please leave a rating and review for all of them. It really does help other people find the shows, which are also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.